Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, gonna let you in on a little behind-the-scenes stuff here. Many years ago, we started doing a series of musical debates. You know, the Soundcheck Smackdown. The subjects were serious, but we also wanted them to be fun. So when it came to theme music for the Smackdowns, I knew the perfect song.
Soundcheck Smackdown!
God, I love that explosion. But the music, it's big and loud and stupid. And I stole the idea for it from Arrested Development. As fans of that TV series know, the final countdown by the band Europe is the cheesy theme song for the Bluth family's oldest son, Job, who is attempting to be a magician with hilariously inept results.
Well, once there was a yacht, now there is not!
All right, so how'd you do it?
Michael?
Magician never reveals his... I sunk it! I sunk the yacht! At least I think I sunk it. I mean, I blew it up and I don't see it anywhere.
Now, one of the things that made Arrested Development such a long-standing cult phenomenon is the music. These recurring sonic jokes and goofy snippets of song. Now that the series is back, so is the music, and we'll speak to the show's composer in just a moment. But we also have live music. The timeless sounds of classic soul and R&B from British singer and guitarist James Hunter's band. And a debate, though not quite a soundcheck smackdown, about this new trend of throwing hashtags into song titles and even album names. So all of that's coming up. But first... This is the story of a TV show that was abruptly canceled, and the fans who kept it together until it could be brought back. And the man who provided the music for the whole thing. It's Arrested Development, and he's David Schwartz. David joins us on the line. David, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hello, John. How you doing?
Good. So music is like a constant presence in this show, often in ways that are noticeable and even more often in ways that are more subliminal. How much music are you actually doing for each episode?
It's even hard to estimate. Very often the amount of... Well, we'll have a spotting session with Mitch and with our fabulous music editor, Jason Trago Newman.
Mitch being Mitch Hurwitz, the creator.
Mitch Hurwitz, yes, the creator and all-around genius of the show. And it'll be 50 to 80 cues very often.
50 to 80 for each half-hour episode.
Yeah, yeah. Now, all of those won't, certainly now in the fourth season, we'll go back to favorites, too.
Right.
But... I'm usually writing upwards of 30 pieces per week for it.
And how does that compare to other TV shows?
This is much more.
Yeah.
But much more fun, too. It really is unique. I've never done anything that's quite like Arrested. Music is everywhere, but yet it works. Because it's always... The type of music we do changes all the time. So it's not like one constant thing
right.
That's running through.
Well, here's a bit of the opening scene from the first episode of the new season of Arrested Development, released on Netflix all at once. Now, while this is playing, try to listen to David Schwartz's music behind the dialogue.
It was May 4th, and in the bayside town of Newport Beach, the annual celebration known as Cinco de Cuatro was underway. The holiday started as a particularly vicious response by a young Lucille Bluth to the Mexican holiday...
Still isn't made?
...of Cinco de Mayo.
No, Rosa! Why is this still a mess?
She said it's Cinco de Mayo. She's taken a day off.
She said that?
Yeah.
She called it Cinco de Mayo?
She did, yeah.
Oh, why can't they just call it May 5th? This is what I was talking about. It's all part of the Mexican
War
on May 5th.
I know, yeah.
Should start our own holiday.
You see, the Hispanics of Newport liked Cinco a lot. But high up on Coast Highway, Lucille Bluth did not.
Doesn't look like they'll be done anytime soon.
And then Lucille had a horrible thought. A thought that was thoughtless and better to not. What if, she thought, with a sneering grin.
Next year, what if the party didn't even begin?
So, there's an obvious throwback to how the Grinch stole Christmas there at the end of that.
Yeah.
How many different musical cues, David, did you write for that scene?
Well, what's left in there, I think, is about four or five. And there was a lot of discussion, of course. We were all coming back to the show after 6 years, and, you know, everything was sort of considered and reconsidered there. And at first, I can't even remember what was supposed to be there. It was something that was very different. And then I didn't think it was working, and Mitchell Hurwitz called me a few days into my process and said, you know, it's got to be swing. That's what we always go with. Let's have a new sort of minor swing tune for the beginning of the show. And I said, great, I wrote one for the end of the show. I think it'll work great in there.
When you say swing, so he means like, you know, the old style, the mid-20th century style of music?
Right. I mean, a lot of the music, if there is one constant always besides the ukulele, it's sort of our homage to 30s and 40s swing, Duke
right.
Ellington, Django Reinhardt, that kind of style. And the fact that we always add ukulele sort of makes it sound like Arrested. You know, sometimes the ukuleles will take the melody itself, but they're often strumming, you know, being a rhythm instrument in there too.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, this season has been a lot more minor in our swing tunes and other things than major.
Now, what about the theme song? I mean, that really revolves ultimately around the sound of the ukulele. You're on the phone with us from Hawaii, and the story is you found this at another island even further into the Pacific, right?
Yes, in Bora Bora. But I'd like to make it clear that, you know, 99% of the time I'm in my studio working 14 hours a day. And I'm pretty lucky when it stops that I get to go someplace. And this was at the very beginning of Arrested Development. I think we started in 2003. And wait, it's pouring in Hawaii here. Let me.
I thought maybe you had just turned a fan on or something. Is that rain?
I just closed all the window, and it's just something we haven't seen all week here—a downstorm. Anyway, yes.
So
in 2003. I had just come back with my wife from Bora Bora, and when I was there, I walked into the first night into the lounge by our hotel, and I heard this absolutely crazy sound, and I looked up, and I couldn't figure it out at first, and I saw that there were two ukuleles and a guitar on stage, a baritone ukulele, which I'm very familiar with, and this sort of high string thing that sounded like a cross between a ukulele and a banjo.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked the large Polynesian man, who spoke a little bit of French, and I speak a tiny bit, and he spoke a little bit of English, if he could get me one of these fantastic ukuleles. And every night he'd come back and say, well, you know, I really tried, but the guy was fishing, you know, and that kind of thing. And then finally, on the last day, he insisted that he'd take me to the luthier's home in Bora Bora, and we drove in his car around the island, and I got the ukulele that became the sound of Arrested Development. And then I wrote the theme around that, and Mitch kept on wanting me to add more things to the theme, and my musical sensibilities, no, we should make this more sparse. It's too crazy. But he won. And I agree with him. He's absolutely right, as he always is. And so we kept on adding it, and finally I think the last thing to go on was the whistle.
The whistling, yeah.
James McVeigh whistling. And then this season, sort of just as fun, every episode adds another instrument.
Now the story of a family whose future was abruptly canceled, and the one son who had no choice but to keep himself together. It's George Michael's Arrested Development.
So that's one of the openings of one of the 15 new episodes of Arrested Development, all released en masse via Netflix. David Schwartz, the composer for Arrested Development. So what makes this? I mean, obviously, everything about this season is different. Lots of binge watching going on because all 15 were released at once.
Right.
Weight of expectations. Aside from those obvious things, what is different about this season for you as the show's composer?
A lot's the same, but a lot is really different. The episodes are much longer.
Mm.
They average over 30 minutes, maybe over 35. And, you know, network television, we get 21 minutes. So, you know, you're sort of expecting an end at 21 minutes, and yet we're in the third act there. So they're longer. It allowed for a lot longer pieces of music, which is really fun. And every episode is really connected, with many of them sharing the same scene from a different angle and from a different character's perspective.
And does the music follow that?
Well, sometimes it would, and then in the final stages we'd be going like, well, are people going to think they're watching episode 5 when we're in episode 7? So then we'd change it to something different there. So sometimes we'd want it to be the same music, and sometimes we'd want it to be different. And well, that was really, you know, Mitch's call in the end.
That actually leads me to a question that comes to us from one of our Twitter followers on Soundcheck. Lex Curry asks, what's the process of using foreshadowing in Arrested Development's music?
That's a good question. I don't think we foreshadowed that much, not as much as other shows where they really want you we want you to know it's scary here.
Right.
Mitch Hurwitz's concern is always that it's going to be too obvious, not that it's going to be too hard to discern what's going on. And I'm trying to think of examples. I'm sure there have been examples where we foreshadowed, where something that, you know.
What about something like, is it Mr. F?
Mr. F.
Mr. F. God, the history of that is so long, it's hard for me to remember. But yeah, we started building into this Mr. F thing. That was going to be a big reveal towards the end of the season.
Was that season 3?
I think that sounds right to me. Yeah.
Where they're in wee Britain, this kind
wee Britain.
this tiny little English suburb in California, and you have distilled decades worth of James Bond theme music into like this little 10-second thing.
And probably had 10 seconds to write it at the time. I mean, that's the unique and I think the best part and also the hardest part about, you know, scoring for television is it just goes by so fast that, you know, you go with your first thought and hopefully that's going to work.
We're speaking with David Schwartz, the composer for Arrested Development. In addition, David, to your music, there are recurring musical jokes of sorts. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's Job, the son who fancies himself
countdown,
a great,
yeah.
Right, the final countdown. And then at various points, including in the new season, when someone has something really sad happen to them, you've got that sad bit of Charlie Brown Christmas music.
Right.
Who chose that?
That's a Mitch thing, I believe, or it came out of the writer's room. If not Mitch, one of the other writers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I recorded it, but it's obviously the classic Vince Guaraldi, Charlie Brown.
Now, when you say you recorded the Charlie Brown Christmas music, you mean that's you at the piano playing it?
It's me at the bass playing it. I think it was Jeff Babko and Peter Erskine playing the piano and drums, respectively.
Okay, so recreating Vince Guaraldi's trio from the old Charlie Brown animated special. This is a musical joke that appears several times over several seasons of Arrested Development. And in the first of the new episodes, Michael, played by Jason Bateman, has just been voted out of his son's college dorm room where he has been living.
Michael did the only thing he could think of that would save face.
And at that point, we see Jason Bateman, head hanging low as he shuffles off down the hallway. There's also that little Bollywood musical cue, which recurs as well. And that's new to this season, isn't it?
I think so. We might have done something like that. You know, so much music has gone by, but I remember that Mitch pitched that because you see Jason sort of going into this sort of prayer pose there. And he said it would be really funny if something like this happened. And what Mitch Hurwitz sang was very, very close to the final thing, which was what I used was a sample that I had from a sample library. I did not. There are other times in this season where I have hired Indian singers, and then we have, the Charlie Brown theme, which only lasts a few bars, but is so evocative it just makes its point and gets laughs at the same time.
Right. Now, then there are other things that you have to come up with. There are things that the characters would be singing or hearing themselves. So Tobias gets himself involved in this whole Fantastic Four thing where it starts as, you know, take your picture on the street with the thing and But it evolves into a Fantastic Four musical, which you not only have to write the music for it, it has to be bad.
Which is, I think, every composer's nightmare. Because very few of us find bad music to be funny. And I think what we came up with when we talked about, first of all, this was done in 1 or 2 days' notice, and I wrote the musical mostly with Gabriel Mann, who's a fantastic singer-songwriter out in L.A., and a composer. The idea was that we, you know, there's this sort of Justin Bieber character who's in the halfway house, and he's writing the music, but he seems he can only write one tune. So the idea was all these shows in this semi-modern Broadway musical would have the same track beneath it, you know, and almost the same melody where we could make it work, and that would be the funniness. And they were all written longer than what you hear, and they were all composed, you know, while that episode was being shot, sometimes on the day that those scenes were happening. So there was a lot of back and forth very quickly, and you know, I remember it was crazy because it was way before I started. Suddenly, has anyone told you about the musical kind of thing? You know? And we went into action.
And at any point, did you and Gabriel look at each other and say, boy, this is really bad?
Oh, constantly. I was very pleased with that. The final medley at the end where it all comes together, which was sort of like a shock, which would have been easier had we planned that from the beginning.
Well, this is how that music plays out at the end of one of the new episodes of Arrested Development.
After weeks of rehearsal, it becomes clear that the unauthorized Fantastic Four musical does not look like it's going to Broadway. But since they worked so hard, we're going to run credits over it.
I love the count up: Fantastic Two, Fantastic Three, Fantastic Four.
Yeah, that was a breakthrough moment.
David Schwartz is the composer for the TV series Arrested Development, and in the past did yeoman work for Northern Exposure. I like that music quite a lot. Deadwood, The Ellen Show, and of course the new series of Arrested Development episodes. As you look back over what is now 4 seasons. I mean, what are the moments that you're proudest of? Are they little hidden things? Are they some of the songs, the yellow joints and balls in the air that get thrown in?
Oh, we just had so much fun. Songs, I will say, are a particular favorite. All those balls in the air. I think that just happened early on. Maybe even in the first episode, we wrote a couple of songs, and that doesn't happen much in television. You know, they usually want some hit of the week, and Mitch didn't want to date the show that way. And he said, well, what if we wrote a song and it would be like this and some really funny concept? We could have so much fun with that. And of course, you know, if you're composing, producing, and recording and delivering 2 extra songs to a whole score, it's a lot of extra work. And it would always happen late at night because I would, you know, for a song, I usually have a co-writer and a collaborator, so that way I could score until I was almost, you know, too exhausted to go any further, and then someone would come in and give a burst of energy, and we'd go a few more hours, and I'd get the song done.
Mm-hmm. For music fans, part of the fun is identifying who you're parodying. Like, you know, Yellow Joint is clearly a parody of Alice's Restaurant, the Arlo Guthrie tune, at least for the first part of it. It turns into this, like, hardcore punk thing briefly at the very end.
Right. What if there was a modern punk version of it? Yeah, that was a very, very, probably too clear parody there.
So, David, what was the original intent of the show's music? What role do you think it plays on the program?
I think something that we spoke about early when we were doing the show was that, you know, Mitch had come from multicam comedies, you know, 4-camera comedies. And the single-camera comedy is different and that it usually doesn't have a laugh track. Mm-hmm. And I think music really replaced that constant laugh track in a lot of ways, just to let you know we're having fun, not so much commenting and saying, oh, this is funny, you know, bring out the trombones. And that's not a slur at trombones. I use them all the time. But
and in the wake of this fourth season of Arrested Development, there's a talk of a movie. Are you likely to be scoring that as well?
Oh, I can say as much as anything could be counted on in TV, I will be scoring it if the movie does happen. And I don't think anyone's positive, but everyone wants to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how the fourth season came about. So I'm hoping the same will happen with the movie.
All right. Well, David Schwartz, composer for Arrested Development, it's been, you'll pardon the pun, perhaps an unsung but really important part of the success of the show. And glad to have you back with the new season. Thanks so much for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you, and I hope we get to meet at some point.
All right. David Schwartz with us on the line from Hawaii, the new season of Arrested Development. All 15 episodes available now on Netflix. This is Soundcheck. Get your tickets today for our next live event in the Green Space. On Wednesday, June 12th, I'll be joined on stage by comedian Tig Notaro, composer Jeff Richmond, and this group, Robert Randolph and the Family Band. That's June 12th at 7 p.m., live with Tig Notaro, Jeff Richmond, and Robert Randolph and the Family Band. Get your tickets today at thegreenspace.org. Coming up, Twitter has already changed the way we share music with one another, but now it's showing up in song titles. The rise of the hashtag song next. And later, a performance that sounds like it could have been recorded in a tweet-free universe. It's the classic soul of the James Hunter Six. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you need any further proof of how Twitter has affected our culture and our language, just look what's happened to the old number sign. You know, the two lines crossed with two other lines. Used to be that was just a symbol to denote the word number. But in the past few years, that humble little symbol has taken on a new title, the hashtag, and new significance on Twitter and other social media. And now it appears to have officially infiltrated the music biz. We have hashtagged song and even album titles popping up all over the industry. Joining me here in the studio today to discuss this are Lexi Mainland, social media editor for the New York Times. Hi, Lexi.
Hashtag hello.
Rembert Brown is a staff writer for Grantland. Hi, Rembert.
How are you?
Good. And William Gruger, social and streaming chart manager at Billboard. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you?
Let me start with you, William.
Sure.
We're seeing a big explosion of this just in the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah. Just in the past few weeks, we had three artists come out with hashtag titled songs or inspired songs. We've had Mariah Carey's hashtag beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We've had Busta Rhymes' hashtag twerk it. And though the name of the song doesn't exactly start with a hashtag, Jennifer Lopez's Live It Up was heavily promoted as hashtag Live It Up.
Okay. So, Rembert, you have written about this trend, and I get the impression you're not crazy about it.
It's not my favorite thing in the world.
Why?
You know, it's less that I'm mad that, I feel like the music industry, like the actual songs are being affected. It just feels kind of insincere. It's like calling something hashtag beautiful. It's just like kind of throwing it in your face that like it's just like promotion right. before the actual song.
Well, isn't it the opposite of insincere? Isn't it just like being completely honest about the fact that, hey, I'm going to promote myself and my song by putting this kind of marker in the title?
In a way it is, but there's still trying to pretend like even when you call it or it's written out hashtag beautiful, they're still pretending that it's the same old song. But when I see it written, when I go to Spotify and I type in beautiful and I see hashtag beautiful, I'm like, oh, this is now about Twitter and Instagram. And then, you know, at some point also about the music.
Mm-hmm. Well, will.i.am recently doubled down on the hashtag thing with the release of his fourth album called Hashtag Willpower, which also features this song that he did with Justin Bieber called Hashtag That Power.
Minute, hour, bigger, better, stronger power. I got that power. I got that power. I got that power. Power, power, power. They call me Willie. Stay so cool, I'm chilly. I done made that melee. On my way to that belly. Used to have a piggy bank, but now I got that bigger bank. Who cares what the haters think? They hate on me cause I'm doing what they can.
Will.i.am. His name is an internet domain name as well. And here he has double hashtag the world by releasing the album Hashtag Willpower and featuring that song with Justin Bieber called Hashtag That Power. Lexi, this all goes back to like Twitter. 2007
yeah, it
or
actually
so.
Goes back, as from what I understand, it goes back before Twitter to the nerdy world of IRC networks where computer geeks were trying to create small groups and conversations, and they were using hashtags as little sort of kind of almost like chat rooms. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, not when Twitter first started, but sometime maybe a year later, hashtags started to pop up there as, again, a way to sort of put metadata into conversations, and they've, you know, they've been used for lots of serious newsy purposes. Especially they had, you know, a huge use during a revolution in Iran a few years ago.
So once Twitter installed a search function, the hashtag was the way that you would, you know, if you were a Charlie Sheen fan, you would just type in hashtag winning and you'd get all the tweets that had something to do with that
under that particular thing. Yeah, it's yeah. sort of used as a way to group topics and ideas.
Now, the funny thing about, I mean, that Will.i.am song, I mean, Rembert, this sort of goes back to what you were saying. He never sings the word hashtag. At no point do they say hashtag that power. Yeah. They just sing that power.
I think it would be really funny if Will.i.am or Robin Thicke or something at some point like whispered like hashtag or something. like just to mix it up, because like it's blatantly happening. Like with the Robin Thicke example, his mm-hmm. song Blurred Lines, it's not hashtag Blurred Lines,
right.
but in the music video, like every 20-25 seconds, there's a giant red hashtag Thicke or hashtag Blurred Lines, and it's almost like subliminal messaging, like, well, not almost, it's just messaging.
It's not, yeah, it's not even
just
subliminal.
In your face, like, this is, like...
It's kind of creepy.
Just let me liberate you. You don't need no papers. That man is not your maker.
Robin Thicke with T.I. and Pharrell with Blurred Lines. So we're talking about hashtags and social media and how this has all sort of affected the or infected the music industry on Soundcheck today. Lexi Mainland is social media editor for The New York Times. Rembert Brown, staff writer for Grantland. William Gruger, social streaming chart manager at Billboard. And William, you've written about this band Cobra Starship, who kind of, they were early adopters of the hashtag titling trend.
Yeah, not the first, but one of the first tracks to really break through on the Billboard charts was a single called One Night. Hashtag One Night, of course.
Hashtag and then the number, the numeral one, and then N-I-T.
Yeah, not to be confused with Number One Night, which some radio DJs were saying as they would announce the song on the radio because they didn't know exactly what it was then. According to the band's frontman, their manager said, hey, why don't we just put a hashtag in front of this song so that way it can like become a trending topic on Twitter?
Did it?
And it did at some point, at one point when it first came out. And they promoted the song on Twitter by asking fans, like, why don't you tell us about like that one night, that sort of, that one night that's really special to you, that one night you'll never forget, thereby giving the concept of one night much bigger meaning than just the name of the song, kind of tying it to an idea.
Well, and also giving their fans kind of ownership of the song in a way.
And giving Cobra Starship ownership over that concept of one night. Gotta live like we got one night, one night, one night. Gotta live like we got one night, one night, one night. Cause you know we just got one life, one life, one life. So gotta live like we got one night.
Cobra Starship is the name of the band. Their 2011 single called One Night, actually written hashtag numeral one and then N-I-T-E, but that is pronounced One Night. We're talking about the influx of hashtags into the music industry, hashtag song titles, hashtag album titles. Lexi, as a social media editor, would you say it's a healthy sign for the music industry that they've adopted this so enthusiastically?
I mean, I don't think anything in media these days can be called purely healthy. I think it's both sort of destructive and helpful. Certainly, you know, if everything has a hashtag and anyone can use a hashtag to get their message out there, then there becomes a lot of noise, and it's really hard to cut through that.
Well, now, that's probably a good segue into talking about the Mariah Carey song, which you've all mentioned already. It's called Hashtag Beautiful. I mean, there's got to be a million different trends, hashtag beautiful, on Twitter and Instagram. So.
Yes, it's actually an ugly phenomenon.
Yeah, I went through, when I wrote about the whole hashtag thing, it was right after the Mariah Carey song came out, and I went through, just to like prove a point, I just clicked hashtag beautiful in Twitter and was just copying, pasting, taking screenshots of hashtag beautiful tweets that had nothing to do with the Mariah Carey and Miguel song. And like, just to prove a point that it's like, I don't understand why, especially when it's a song that's actually really good and doesn't, I don't even think needs that extra bump of kind of like hokey promotion. Like, why?
Well, plus you've got Miguel, who's, you know, a not rising star, he's risen. And Mariah Carey, who's making this, you know, really much ballyhooed comeback.
Yeah. And a song that just stands on its own as like a very good song. I just thought
it
was
a great video.
Yeah, it's the only thing about the song that I don't like
is the title.
Yeah.
William, is it a misstep putting the hashtag in front of a term like beautiful that is used so frequently?
Well, I mean, Rembert said it pretty well. Beautiful applies to a lot of things. You know, my dog is beautiful, for instance. But, you know, where in one way it can be mixed in with a lot of clutter, it can also help that particular song or an image with that song be a part of that topic. So, for instance, if I'm looking at things that are beautiful on Tumblr and I'm scrolling through dogs and beaches, oh, hey, there's that Mariah Carey song. And as media consumption moves more and more towards feeds, my Twitter feed, my Facebook feed is where I discover content, marketers are always looking for ways to get their content into those feeds, and a hashtag is a good way to do that.
Well, it was just very recently that Mariah tweeted that the explicit version of the song was being released, and you could, quote, find out what the hashtag means, unquote. You're not going to find that out here on the radio, but here's the family-friendly version of the song, hashtag beautiful. Yeah, you're beautiful. Good Lord, you're beautiful. The song is not beautiful, but hashtag beautiful, from Mariah Carey with Miguel. And we're talking about hashtags, social media, and how it has sort of appeared recently in album titles, song titles. William, is there any evidence that all of this hashtagging is making a difference in sales and charting and things like that?
Not really yet. You know, the artists that you would expect to sell a lot of records, Mariah Carey, you know, their hashtag songs do better. That's kind of expected. But what we do see are that artists that name their hashtag songs after more specific terms that they can kind of take ownership over, like we've discussed, show much higher spikes in engagement around that term when the song is released, which kind of hints that online people are reacting to that song or that word as applies to their song rather than just the term in general.
But that reaction is happening in social media, like Twitter mm-hmm. and Instagram,
yeah, exactly.
Which by almost by its nature is a very quick, ephemeral thing. It's like, hey, there's the song. Oh, look, a puppy.
Right.
Like, and now the song is forgotten.
Here one day, gone the next. And in all these cases, buzz around those particular hashtags die right back down to their sort of baseline levels in the 2 or 3 days that follow the song's release.
Well, it's just so weird. We're talking about all these songs with hashtag in the title. You hear all the songs, and as I mentioned before, you never hear anybody sing or say the word hashtag. Is that, Lexi, is that next? Is that the inevitable next step? And at what point does this wave crest and crash and leave us alone?
I don't know at what point the wave will crest and crash, but I suspect that it will. I mean, it does all seem very trendy, and it does feel to me often like, you know, 5 years from now we're going to look back at this and think of it as sort of like that jean jacket where we collected all these pins back in the 80s.
Those are coming back, though.
Like, why did we do that? Why were we using puffy paints to decorate our sweatshirts? And I think, you know, this is going to be some sort of historical artifact of the 2000s that is going to creep us out a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think we're going to see people naming their hashtags songs hashtags forever, but I definitely don't think we're going to stop seeing that sort of organic naming of mm-hmm. movements or tying a hashtag onto a song coming from within a community.
Well, it's here now, and we'll see how long it stays around. Hashtags in album titles, song titles, who knows, maybe it'll be in films and book titles next. We've been speaking with Lexi Mainland, social media editor for The New York Times, Rembert Brown, staff writer at Grantland, and William Gruger, social and streaming chart manager at Billboard. And to the three of you, hashtag thanks very much for being here.
Absolutely.
Thank you. There was a silent hashtag in there. Yeah.
And here's a little bit from Jennifer Lopez featuring Pitbull. She has also jumped on the hashtag bandwagon with this song called Hashtag Live It Up. Okay, now I want you all to put that hashtag knowledge to good use. Soundcheck needs your help for an upcoming segment on the always controversial topic, of progressive rock. Next week, I'll speak with some of the writers behind a new essay collection called Yes is the Answer and Other Prog Rock Tales. But what is prog rock anyway? There are probably as many different definitions as there are key changes in a song by Yes. We want to hear how you define the term. Call us at 1-866-939-1612 or tweet us at Soundcheck with the hashtag ProgRock. That's 866-939-1612 or tweet us at Soundcheck with the hashtag ProgRock. And that, folks, is the way hashtags should be used. Up next, an in-studio performance from the James Hunter Six. This is Soundcheck.
That's one hard word too many. You better let me back. I've begun already. If I could stand to see you crack, what kind of fool would I be?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Depending on your age, this might sound like something your parents or even grandparents would have danced to back in the day. But this album from James Hunter was released just earlier this year. The R&B and soul singer's third album is called Minute by Minute, and the James Hunter Six are here with me in the studio today to play some of those songs for us. This one is called Chicken Switch, here live on Soundcheck, the James Hunter Six. The James Hunter Six playing and, yes, doing a bit of squawking here in the studio with a song called Chicken Switch. James Hunter singing and playing the guitar. I'll introduce you to the rest of the Six in a moment. But, James, good to have you with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks very much, John.
That's so when the going gets rough and you've had enough, hit the chicken switch.
That's right. It's based on what my grandmother used to tell me. If at first you don't succeed, turn it in.
Well, you know, the wisdom of the ages passed down. So on the surface, it's a funny song. On the other hand, you know, there's lines like "Remember what you want, remember what you need."
That's it. As if you're going to go for something, make sure you really want it. I suppose that's the if there's a moral involved.
Yeah.
Know?
Well, I mean, it's been a number of years since your last record. So
yeah.
Was this a case of you having to figure out what you wanted and what you needed?
It wasn't sort of discretion being a better part of valor. It's just I'm a bit of a slow writer.
Okay. So the new album is called Minute by Minute from the James Hunter Six. It features Damian Hand on tenor sax, Lee Badow playing baritone sax, Kyle Kohler playing keyboards, Jason Wilson on bass, David Mason on drums. And this lineup has become pretty set now, right?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, we've got a couple of new fellas there. We've got Jason's only been with us for about 24 years, but the rest of them have been sort of diehards, you know.
Now, you know, that brings up, I mean, you have had a long career, but you were in your 40s when that first record came out.
People the first record that did anything, I was about 44.
Right. So that was People Gonna Talk, which was the first time you were on Soundcheck.
That would have been.
Yeah, back in 2006. What else were you doing, you know, in those years leading up to that before you had the recording contract?
Stabbing. I did a lot of busking and, you know, sometimes I did labouring work and stuff like that. But I never stopped doing gigs, you know, it was lack of imagination, really.
So growing up in England, I mean, we think of the whole blue-eyed soul thing as a very northern thing, you know, people around Sheffield and places like that. You grew up in Essex, right?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that. But I think if you're thinking of the sort of the northern soul scene, that was mostly buying records, really. So you could have any colour eyes to do that.
Yeah, I guess.
But
so.
In Essex, there wasn't particularly a scene of any sort, really.
Yeah. So how did you get into this music?
Oh, I don't know. I think somebody played me an example of it, and I just got into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was there wasn't anything. It was only till I got into London I found there were other people of a like mind.
Because there's been, obviously, a huge resurgence of this here in the States. As you well know, having worked recently with the guy who founded Daptone Records, Gabriel Roth, who you know, did the Amy Winehouse record and here on these shores, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Has it been a similar phenomenon on your side of the Atlantic?
It's hard to tell. With the advent of, you know, with the internet picking up speed and everything, you can't tell whether something... whether something's being picked up in the States or here. It all seems to blend into one country these days.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, if there's a continuing interest in something, it tends to be worldwide now.
Now, your career, you do have gigs that take you back to the 90s, and at some point you crossed paths with Van Morrison, who heard
and
you.
Swords.
Is that true?
Nah, got on all right.
And he took you on tour, right?
That's right, yeah.
As what, a backing singer or guitarist?
No, it was like a guest spot. You know, it was like I was the only obscure guest he had. You know, we had the rest of them were luminaries like Junior Wells and people like that.
Wow.
And then when he wanted to really slum it, he'd bring me on. So I was just he'd just bring me on for the sort of material that we might have in common. Because sometimes we supported him. We'd go on before him as a band. And then during his bit, I'd... you know, if he did a Guitar Slim song or something like that, he'd drag me on for it.
Yeah. Now, did you do covers or were you writing your own stuff back then, too?
I was writing my own stuff, but with him I was doing sort of stuff we had in common.
Right, which would be like what?
Well, like the aforementioned Guitar Slim, we might do Things I Used to Do or sometimes the odd James Brown song. He used to get me up for doing It's a Man's World.
Really?
Yeah, that was good. A strain on the pipes, that one was.
Do you find here in the States that your accent is so convincing that when you stop singing and start talking, people are like, oh, he's a Brit?
Yeah. I'm thinking of doing it the other way around and seeing how well we get on.
Can you do that? Can you fake it?
I woke up this morning. That will.
We're speaking with James Hunter and hearing some live music from the James Hunter Six. They will be back here in New York to play the Lowdown Hudson Blues Fest on July 10th. It's a kind of a classic, timeless sound, the old blues, R&B, the soul sounds that
that you've mined over the course of your career.
It's just we kind of look at it as a style rather than, I say we, I mean me, as a style rather than a genre, you know. It's just because we do get tagged with this sort of revivalist sort of thing, and it's just trying to do groovy music.
And also revivalist
execution is all it is.
Yeah, and that suggests that it went away at some point. And this kind of music never really went away, did it?
Yeah.
Let's. You want to do another song?
Yeah, certainly. Let's just do One Way Love. Should we do One Way Love, gentlemen?
One Way Love it is, from the James Hunter 6, live on Soundcheck.
I found out boy, natural fact. What you hand out, you don't always get back. Well, now before I turn my feet, that lonely dead end street they call. One way love, one way love. I got you, but it sure was fun. One way love is better than none. Yeah. She fixed her hair while I was playing for real. I never, never, never should let her deal. Oh, I finally turned my back on that single line of track they call. One way love, one way love. Could have been worse for a dummy run, cause one way love is better than none. Yeah. One way love is better than none. Do me fine until the real thing come. Better fools go than a mountain of tin. A chance I'd do the same again. Oh, I finally made it back from that lonely cul-de-sac they call. One we love, one we love. Roll it back and let it run. One we love is better than a
James Hunter 6 and One Way Love, live in the Soundcheck studio. You'll find it on James's most recent album called Minute by Minute. Tell me about working with Gabriel Roth, the founder of Daptone Records, on this new album. What did that do for or to the sound of the band?
Well, it basically cleaned it up and made it more... cleaned it up is possibly the wrong word, but made it a bit more... well, it gave it a lot more clarity, but a lot more aggression, which is what we wanted. And, he helped with the arrangements and getting everything out of each other's way. And we've never had it so sort of sound so three-dimensional before.
Mm.
And we've not had a record that really punches its way out of the speakers until we did with him.
And you did this record here in the States?
Yes, that's right.
In California?
In California, in Riverside.
And did that have any bearing? I mean, did you... feel like, you know, the proverbial fish out of water, a bunch of Brits doing blues music in California.
Yeah. A very smelly place. It was very ramshackle because he hadn't had a chance to sort of do anything with it. He had to repair the roof and disinfect it for reasons which we won't go into. And I think they added a certain patina,
Well, the James Hunter 6 will be back here in New York. They'll be playing the Lowdown Hudson Blues Festival here in town on July 10th. They've been playing for us here on Soundcheck today. And James, to you and the Six, thank you so much for coming in and playing for us.
Thanks very much, John. Say thank you, fellas.
Thanks, John. Where are we going, Johnny?
Yeah, my hammer rang when it hit the ground. When my hammer gives in, my heart was still found. For you,
for you,
for you,
for you.
Oh, 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 nothing I wouldn't do. Well, I work all week for the company man. Every penny I keep from his grabbing hand is for you.
All we have time for on the show tonight, but there's more from the James Hunter Six on our website. More conversation and another in-studio performance on soundcheck.org. Tomorrow night, join us for my conversation with author John F. Goodman, who has collected his rare interviews with the jazz bassist and composer Charles Mingus for a new book called Mingus Speaks. And the band known as Wooden Indian Burial Ground joins us for a very loud edition of Blind Date, our series where we set you up with a band we think you'll love. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, George Wellington, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop with Alex Kappelman and our intern Caroline Scannell. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. See you back here tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.